To sync this podcast to the episode, pause now and hit play right after the previously on.
Hi, I'm Tony Graffia, executive producer and writer of Outlander, and we're here today with the Outlander podcast for episode 506, Better to Marry Than Burn. And my guest today is Stephanie Shannon, our story editor last season for season 5.
Hi, Tony. I'm really glad to be here today. I'm excited to talk about this episode.
I know. It's such a good episode, such a really great episode. And Stephanie did an amazing, amazing job on this episode. I have to say, this is one of my favorite story arcs of this season is the Jocasta Murtaugh story. And if I had to pick another episode that I would have died to write this season, it was this one. Oh. So there was a high bar, and I have to say you knocked it out of the park on this and did a great, great job with it. So were you drawn to this part of the book when you read?
Yeah, I definitely was. I loved this section of the book. It was so evocative and beautifully done with Jocasta's wedding and just how she and how kind of she describes the beauty of the ceremony and the food and the dancing and all, and it was just such a great part of the book. And also the way we open the episode with Jocasta's memory of when she lost her daughters was my favorite part of the book.
One of my favorite parts as well. And yeah. This title, Better to Marry Than Burn, that was...
Yeah, that's the title of the section of the book for Jocasta's wedding, and I thought it really spoke true to the theme of the episode too, in the sense that, you know, I write about how the Jocasta's family motto is I shine not burn, and I thought that that was a really good way to show that she's kind of been strong her whole life, given up a lot and sacrificed a lot, and that she still has like become this incredibly strong woman. And so I wanted to, you know, evoke that in the title as well.
Yeah, it's a perfect title. And just this, you know, Jocasta's backstory is something that we've always talked about in the writer's room for the last couple of seasons and always wanted to find the perfect place to put it. And we've talked about it for other episodes and it just fell out. It didn't quite work, so we didn't pursue it. But it fit in this episode. And it's so poignant because Jocasta is such a strong, stern character. I would say she's likable, but it's not like she's warm and fuzzy. Yeah. And here's where you learn maybe why she is the way she is in it. And Maria Doyle Kennedy, she's amazing, right?
Yeah, I was so excited to write for her. I can't tell you. I feel so lucky.
Me too.
When we were breaking this, I wanted this so badly because I just thought, like you said, like we don't really ever get to know Jocasta that well until this moment. We never really...
Yeah.
You know, understand why she is the way she is, and to know that she had this whole other portion of her life that she never talks about with children, and that she suffered this kind of unthinkable tragedy is just such a window into her character that was so exciting
absolutely.
To explore.
And Maria gets to play her younger self here.
Yeah, and
Maria is not that old, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
She's not as old as Jocasta, and she's a gorgeous woman, and
yeah.
With the makeup and all, you know, she looks Jocasta's age, but here she's just so beautiful in her daughter's.
And we get to see her when she has her sight, which is really exciting.
Exactly.
Which is like such a new thing. And oh my gosh.
I liked how the colors in this, we're watching it. It's just, the colors are so brilliant.
It's beautiful. And it was great to get to go back to Scotland in the story too. And I was really excited to be able to do that in this episode because we really hadn't. We did a little bit in the flashback and the premiere, but, you know, for the most part, this is a treat to be able to do this.
It really is. I don't recall seeing green on the Redcoats uniforms in other episodes. I wonder if that's the first time we've done this.
Huh.
Must have been something special about that particular era, which is, like you said, it's the day after Culloden.
Yeah.
This is shocking. Truly shocking.
I know.
I believe this is one of Meryl's favorite parts, too. I know that she likes Jocasta's backstory and was always wanting to get the daughters in one of our episodes.
Yeah. I know. It just, like, really affected me when I read it in the book. And I just was so excited we had a reason to put it in the show, that it really tied into Jocasta's story this episode.
Was the ribbon something that you, this transition coming up with the ribbon, not something you added?
Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be something she'd held on to all these years. You know, it's obviously symbolic that she's always carried this pain with her and that she's taken it to America and that she, you know, it's locked away in her bedroom and this, you know, and I wanted her to keep that memory of her daughter, and it turned out really well, I think.
Oh, it's lovely. I thought that was a really lovely transition.
Thank you.
Here to...
Yeah, it's like the one piece of her she has left.
She's thinking about it on this particular day, the day of her wedding. Why?
Yeah, because I think it's just her, she's going into a new family. You know, she's marrying, she's going into a new chapter of her life, and I think it's remembering her original family and just remembering everything she's lost and kind of what she's sacrificed in her life and what it means for her on this particular day.
Right.
And I think also you'll see that another reason is that in the next scene she's bequeathing River Run to Jemmy, and so she's also thinking about inheritance, the fact that she has no children.
Right. That's
and
right.
Kind of why that is.
Poor Duncan Ennis. We feel kind of sorry for him. He just cannot compete with Murtaugh.
No. But he's a sweet guy, though.
He's a nice guy, but don't you love how sort of the audience was guessing, like, is Murtaugh going to replace Duncan Ennis in the series? He's going to marry Jocasta, and I think we pulled a bit of a fast one because, if remind me, but I believe there was a time where we were not going to use Duncan. Not that we were going to make Murtaugh fit exactly into Duncan's role, but we did plan. You were reminding me earlier today that we were going to have Jocasta and Murtaugh were going to marry at one point.
Yeah.
And then after, for various reasons, we changed that and did bring in Duncan.
Yeah, I remember that was, having Duncan was kind of a later decision. So it was fun seeing people guess Murtaugh because it was like, well, it used to be that. But I'm glad that we kept it this way.
Well,
because it's so tragic that she's doing this, knowing that she's never really going to love him as fully as she could Murtaugh, but that it's, you know, she's a practical woman. And
you know, her reason, I thought her reasons were very valid, that, you know, this is about the regulators and a cause and the men of causes, and the tying in her history is very relevant because it's, she suffered so much from being caught up in this cause, and that's what she's gotten away from with this life in America. And now, even though she loves Murtaugh, to have to risk falling in love and living a life with a man with a cause that could cause her this kind of pain, it maybe it's the only thing that could stand in the way of trying to be happy.
Yeah, so you really get why she makes this decision. It really, seeing what she went through and that her husband, you know, essentially killed their daughter because of the cause. It's like, well, you understand why she would be making this decision all these years later. And it goes along with her thinking about Morna on this particular day.
She lost all of her daughters in this cause. And it's the one thing that could stand in the way of her and Murtaugh. So
because I think we wanted to understand her point of view on this, because otherwise, you know, it's like, why is she not, you know, going to be with the man that she loves? And I think we understand Murtaugh's point of view, but we really get to see Jocasta's point of view in this episode,
right?
Which is really special.
So she's leaving River Run. She's not exactly leaving him to, she's actually making Jemmy the owner of River Run.
Right.
She's not just making him an heir who will inherit after she's gone, the way she tried to do with Jamie.
Right.
She's giving it, and that is a distinction, and it's important. It'll become important for story reasons later, which I can't remember if it becomes clear in this episode or perhaps in the next.
Yeah.
I think
partly in this episode.
It's at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know what you're talking about. I'm racking my brain.
Because it means that he's the current owner, but it's under the guardianship of of Jocasta and Duncan, but Jemmy really is a rich man legally right now.
Right, but
as opposed to not only when he becomes of age, he owns it now.
Yeah, exactly. I remember it was, we wanted to have a Brianna Roger story back on the ridge because we just, maybe we didn't at one point and it was just all about the wedding, but then we decided that it was, we really wanted to see how they were handling being kind of, you know, in charge while Jamie's gone and how especially Roger would handle it because he's been having so much trouble with his, you know, relationship with Jamie and him feeling like he can't fill this role of captain that Jamie's given him. And we really wanted to kind of put him to the test here. And so we created this, you know, Roger Brianna story to put into this episode.
Yeah, it's interesting when we have so many characters to serve now, Jamie and Claire being our main couple, but we can't always have everybody together as part of the same story. It's very challenging.
Yeah.
So we sometimes look to separate the couples or the whoever the story is about so that we can cut between them. And we did think of, at one point in the story arcing, to bring Bree and Roger to the wedding. But then we thought, exactly as you just said, let's give them their own story. And the locust story was something in the book that also you liked. And it didn't go, I think sometimes we mix and match because I don't think the locusts happen.
Yeah, it happened actually during book six.
It happened in, it's in
so
a different
book. So we pulled it from there. And it was actually in book six was Claire had dealt with locusts while Jamie had been away and she had burned the fields. And so we used that as inspiration. And then and we were like, well, what if this had happened while Jamie had been away and Roger was there? And so
right,
that was kind of how we had gone about it. Side note, this is going back a little, but that kitten is so cute.
Oh, Adso is great. I know. Adso's is totally good. You have a cat.
I have a cat and I'm obsessed with my cat. And so like while they were shooting this, they would send me videos of Adso and I was like, I would just watch them constantly because they're so, he was like playing with the little locust.
Very,
so cute.
Very cute cat.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So Gary Steele, our production designer, did an incredible job with this episode.
Oh, I think this was probably maybe one of his favorite episodes this season because he got to create this amazing, magnificent, the wedding, you know, the wedding decorations and the, what do you call that? A pavilion, I believe.
I think it's a pergola.
I'm not sure.
It's one of the two.
This is why we're not set.
Yeah, exactly.
We're like, just build something really pretty and
really
amazing.
Pretty. And then he takes it away and makes it incredible.
Yeah. It's stunning. And it's, of course, up to Jocasta's.
Yeah.
You know, her standards.
I know. I'm planning my own wedding right now, and I just keep thinking, like, this is not going to compare to this wedding that I wrote.
this is
so much nicer than what I could afford.
Didn't you say you were going to hand fast?
I am hand fasting. Yeah, we are.
That's amazing.
And it's honestly kind of inspired by working on Outlander, because we talked so much about hand fasting. I think it's such a cool tradition.
I know.
So my fiancé and I are we doing a hand fast.
I think you might need to learn a little Gaelic.
I know.
Gaelic. Oh, God, I always say it wrong. but you should learn a little bit and put a little Scots in there,
I think.
And, you know, do a little whiskey toast.
Oh, man, I might, actually. I know we were actually going to get married in Scotland, but then we didn't do it. But both of us are
I think you're
really
a little
obsessed.
Bit busy. Actually, I should mention that we actually stole Stephanie from Ron Moore's other show, For All Mankind. She had worked on the first season and did a great job. And so it was Meryl that recognized your talents and gave you to us. Mm. And then, you know, you did a great job over here, but you've gone actually back for, when you finished here, you went back for the second season of For All Mankind. Yeah. And we actually had to steal you for today so we could get you to come do the podcast because you're not with us this season and we do miss you. But who do you like better? I don't want to put you on the spot, but Outlander or that space show?
I mean, when you put it like that space show, I love them both. They're extreme. I cannot imagine two completely different shows.
Yeah.
It's so funny that they're both, you know, Ron Moore, because they're just so different. And they're both great. But it was funny for me going between a, you know, 18th century period drama and then going over and like working on the moon set. And it was just,
I know you sometimes would leave and they were still shooting. You'd be like, I'm going to the moon today.
Yeah.
And I'll be back tomorrow. And it was like crazy. Yeah. But what a, you know, what a fun year you must have had to do both of these things.
Oh yeah. And I feel so lucky because they're just, they're such good shows and they were both so much fun to write. Remember, we found out about this Johnston Riot Act from our research. This, they bring it up here, and this was something that isn't in the books, but we had discovered it in our research of the time, and we wove into the plot, and it really kind of fit in nicely. This idea that Tryon would pass this legislation that would prohibit people from rioting.
Well, this was some very sneaky legislation because it basically stated you could be arrested retroactively for anything that you did. So what he did, it was, I mean, it's kind of a evil genius, but not very fair, was he pardoned a bunch of people and made them think that they were no longer, you know, in danger of being arrested. And then he pulled the trigger on this new law that said you could be arrested retroactively if you'd been seen at a riot or if you ever gathered with, you know, 10 or more people, I think, and which basically prohibited assembly and prohibited free speech and prohibited anyone from conspiring against the government. But the retroactive part was really not fair, and that's how they went. And they were even allowed that if a felon or this criminal resisted, they could be shot on sight. Yeah. So basically they could walk up to someone and go, you were seen at the riot 6 months ago. And if the person resisted arrest, they could be actually killed. So it was very dangerous and very bad. And Jamie's, you know, had to work around Tryon, who's been not a nice guy.
Yeah. And in history, he did really go to New York around this time. So it was, so it really kind of worked well with our story.
He did. For him, North Carolina was a stepping stone, and he used it basically to glorify himself so he could take the governorship of New York, which was a bigger, you know, a bigger office.
Yeah, he's definitely had a political ladder he was climbing.
Yeah. So here's where you're back to the Roger story, where he's having to deal with the locusts. You know, I was in Scotland for the block after this. This was still shooting while I was prepping.
Okay.
The next episode. And I remember walking through the office in the front office lobby of the studio one day, and I saw these boxes with holes in them little legs sticking out. And I was like, what is that? What's that coming through the mail? And then I noticed on the side of the box, it had a piece of tape and it said live insects
was
on the box. And I thought these, and then someone goes, they're the locusts. And I go, did someone mail the locusts to us? And I never found out more details about it, but it appeared they were on the table with the other packages.
I remember them telling me someone, that they were actually breeding locusts.
Well, I think I took a picture of them, so maybe that'll end up in the next Making of Outlander book. I'm going to have to give that, because I thought that was so interesting. But it freaked me out a little, I got to say. There were actual locusts in a box in the office.
Yes, so funny.
And
I know, I can't believe that. I never thought we would use real locusts, because I remember early on they were like, literally breeding them or something. I think they had to get like permission from the UK government or something.
Well,
to, like, be
able
to
some
do
of it is special effects. I mean, most of it is special effects, and our swarm, which is coming up, looks really good.
Yeah.
But I think there are some close-up shots or places where they used real locusts. And just to be clear, no locusts were hurt in the making of Outlander.
Yeah,
but we always try to be as authentic as possible, so you don't want something to look fake. So I believe we did use partially some live oak locusts.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is the infamous Mr.
Philip Wiley.
He He is played by Chris Donald. Yeah. And he, I don't know if the audience will remember, but he had a very a small part. I believe it was only one line at the Lillington dinner.
Yeah.
In episode, I believe it was 401.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he has a much bigger role here. I'm sure he was surprised that to get a call that was like,
he's like, really?
All right, time to come back. Yeah. And I hope the audiences do remember him because he did a great job.
Yeah, he's such a fun character in the book.
He's a really fun character.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would have been so easy to go over the top with him. You want a little bit of that eccentricity, but he has to be real. He has to have a side to him that, you know, is a little dangerous and that he's a little unpredictable.
Yeah.
So, but I think luckily he was perfect for this part and you were happy with him.
I was definitely happy with his performance and I think he just did a great job. And it's just, you get that he's really attracted to Claire and that, you know, that he would do anything to kind of to be with her. And so I think that's, he did a great job.
Now, how much research did you have to do about ways to deal with locusts and get rid of locusts?
To this day,
I remember there was a lot. There was the building of fans. There was some Brianna was designing.
Yeah, we went through a turbines lot of iterations of this, which to this day, I still get pictures like from Shayna. Like she'll text me if she sees a locust out and about in LA. She'll like send it to me because it was such. Because we went through so many different iterations of this because it's difficult because the wedding doesn't take place over more than a couple of days, and so they didn't have long to come up with the solution to this problem. And we kind of thought maybe she would use her engineering skills to build some kind of Da Vinci-esque contraption.
Right. I remember sketches being passed around like Brianna designs this and it's gonna
And I was up at night in my house just like trying to come up with like these complex contraptions that they could use to defeat these locusts. And it ended up the simplest solution was really the best, that they would just use smoke. And obvious.
Smoke is effective and works. And I think we wanted to make sure that it was believable. And even though she has these skills, it's not maybe something that she could credibly build that fast.
Right. Like, I think at one point she was doing something with, like, an aquifer system or something with like water running down like hills, and it was just like so complex. And it just kind of, that's how it goes in the writing process, is that you whittle it down eventually to what it needs to the simplest version.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jamie's in a really tough position in this episode because he's literally there with Tryon and he has this information about Murtaugh that he just doesn't know what to do with, and it's so hard for him, kind of walking between two fires, as we've said before in this scene.
He has a very fancy tent.
I know. I know. Gary just always just does such a good job with everything.
He's got a little bar in there with some bottles of stuff. He's got a bed in there, like a full bed.
No,
you know, not just like a little, you know, bear skin on the ground or nothing. He's got
this was
nicer than my house.
I know, literally. Like, well, that's something Matt actually reminded me of when I was writing this, is that I would always want to say that people had just arrived to the wedding and like they were greeting each other like, oh, like, you know, you just got here and, you know, I haven't seen you yet. But in reality, people would arrive to these things weeks early and just set up these elaborate tents and really just like stake out a little living situation for themselves at these events. And so it's interesting how, and from a modern perspective, you don't think about it like that. But
and the big house is large, but actually there's no guest rooms, especially now because this season they're still building, they're still they're still, you know, finishing. The inside of the house isn't completely finished because realistically it would take them a while. So I think even Jamie and Claire are not even in their own bedroom.
Yeah.
So it's not like they have room to put up all these guests. So they were all in tents.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, we incorporated this into the solution as well.
Is that what I think it is?
Yeah, it is. I mean, hopefully not really, but in the story. Oh my gosh. This is also great bonding for Roger and Brianna, just to solve something together and to have them, like, be at a better place by the end of this episode.
Yeah, they've been fighting a lot this season, but this is a... We wanted to give them a victory, if yeah. I remember right. They just needed a win.
Yeah, exactly. They've been through a lot, so we were like, they need to be able to overcome something together. Oh my gosh, I still can't get over this set.
Yeah, this...
Oh, Wiley.
This is the table full of presents.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the mole, do we want to talk about the authenticity of this was interesting, that men, when they did their makeup and powdered wigs and all, they would apply a mole, right?
Oh, yeah. That was definitely in fashion at the time. And I remember looking into, they would have all different shapes. Like, it would be like a star or like a half moon or like, whoa, you know, it was a whole big thing. And that they would have like whole collections of these things.
It was considered attractive.
Yeah. Definitely in France, I believe. I think that's where it was kind of originated. And I think it was probably just because people had such terrible skin. It was like just to like cover up, you know, like actual imperfections.
Because I remember that being something that was kind of funny in the book, that when he tries to kiss her and Jamie sees that the mole has come off and it's stuck to Claire or something crazy.
And we kept that. I think that's actually in there. Coming up.
It's coming up.
This is when she kind of figures out that he might know Stephen Bonnet.
Yes.
Which was, that was hard to write because we didn't want it to be, because he wouldn't, come out and say it, you know, so we had to have Claire be clever enough to infer and to be able to figure it out herself.
Yes.
Jamie's whiskey.
Yeah, I remember in the writer's room we wrestled with, how do we get Claire to figure out? And, you know, it can't be like Stephen Bond, it's the only, you know, he's always everywhere, but he was a smuggler. He did a lot of business.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, so he notices her rings.
Well, it's highly unusual that she would be wearing two rings.
Yeah.
And I believe there's only one other time we've had that commented on. And
it
was by Stephen Bonnet. It was by Stephen Bonnet, I believe, in...
Yeah.
When was it? Because that's...
Is it when the premiere of season 4 when he steals it?
Yeah, I believe it's at the beginning of 401 when they meet Stephen Bond in the graveyard, and then
that's right. Yeah,
yeah, he's in the cart. I think that was an episode of mine and Matt's where he's telling her his story about being afraid of drowning, mm-hmm. and he notices when she's tending his wound, her rings.
Yeah,
so it's interesting. This guy, he's noticing it, but it's his jealousy of Jamie, and his kind of. I remember we talked about him wanting to have those rings and wanting to win them in the game is not even so much about the monetary, you know, value mm-hmm. of the rings, but kind of wanting to be like, I'm going to take your wedding ring from Jamie because he's jealous and he wants Claire. So it was more symbolic, symbolic victory.
Yeah, because she humiliates him in the next scene or the one after. She rejects him and shoves him into like the horse dung, and I think after that she's telling him in this scene how important that ring is to her, and so he knows that that's the one thing that he can get that would really hurt her, that would give him some kind of victory over her. But then of course here she's just trying to kind of get information about Bonnet.
Hmm. God, Claire looks great there.
I know. She always looks great.
She always looks great, but geez.
Yeah, she looks beautiful. Yeah, because this was the first kind of opportunity she's had to really dress up this season, I think. Because everything else has been kind of on the ridge, or she's been, you know, in just regular clothes. And so it was nice to have everybody dressed up in this episode.
The costumes are so beautiful. Yeah, her hair's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I know he's about to show her his horse. I know you also did some research on the horse, right? And
I found
like the true horse of that era that was a famous horse, and this horse is related to that?
Yes. I think at first I said it was I don't even know horse terminology, like the foal of that horse. But then we found out it would probably have been like, he would have been his grandsire. And luckily we have Stephen Allison, two other writers. That are like, I think they breed horses or they're big horse people.
Yeah, they're big horse people.
Super helpful in helping with all of the horse research. This looks so beautiful, the way they shot it with the smoke and everything. I remember for inspiration, we watched Days of Heaven and just how beautiful that movie is with the locust fire.
It seems like such a, you know, silly thing. Oh, this is from the main titles, by the way. This shot of them holding hands with the smoke.
Oh, cool.
Actually, my credit goes over that shot.
Oh, nice.
I noticed because I always, every year I'm like, which card's my credit going to go on? And this year it's over the locust shot.
Oh, that's
so
awesome. I'm glad I could give you that gift.
So thank you, Stephanie.
You're welcome.
The locusts seem like not a big deal, but it's a huge deal because it's a small insect, but obviously it, you know, especially in these times, it destroys their crops, their food for the whole year, and can really cause starvation and death. So it's a very, very serious problem.
Yeah.
That even goes on today.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I remember we did a lot of research into the 19th century American locust plagues, especially in like Colorado. There was this breed of locust called the Rocky Mountain locust that is extinct now, but I read a lot of accounts from that era, and it was just horrifying the way that people would walk outside and there'd just be this storm cloud of locusts coming off the horizon. Like it just sounded like a freight train, and the way they described it was so visceral, and like it just, you know, doesn't sound like a huge deal, but back then when that was your whole livelihood, it was destroyed whole communities.
I mean, we talk a lot about this era and the culture of this era, you know, especially with Matt, we're bringing up all the time that, you know, you have to be cognizant of the fact that, like, in this era, a woman wouldn't go into the barn with a man. That just wasn't done. And so Claire, she's being very aggressive to find out this information about Bonnet, but she's put herself in a position, and of course it's in no way her fault that he got the wrong idea. It's just that in those times, you know, sometimes her modernism gets her in trouble.
Yeah.
Because she forgets maybe that this is something that might send a signal to in society if it's something that's unusual or not done. So this guy, you know, he's a creep anyway. I mean, the way he attacks her, but...
Right. But we talk about that a lot in the room, just making sure that we're not looking at things from a modern perspective, which is so easy to do. Like with, you know, with this and just everything, even the little things like I was talking about, like how long people are at weddings, just things that like you would never think of in our modern day world. But then you have to really, Matt's very good about like reminding us that we have to examine this from a lens of actually, you know, someone in the time. And, you know, if you saw her going in that barn with Wiley, you'd think, oh, well, that's...
Oh, it would be a huge scandal.
Yeah. This is so pretty.
Yeah, the colors.
The colors of this are just like...
The colors in this episode are some of the really most vibrant that I've seen It's stunning to watch. It really is.
Yeah.
I know we added, you know, some stock shots of Locust Seer.
I think it was big VFX kind of episode. I felt guilty. I was like, this is an expensive episode.
This is probably our VFX budget for the whole season.
Yeah, I know. I was like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, thanks, Stephanie.
I know. It's really, I'll pay you guys back.
And you're like, but all they're doing is swishing smoke around with blankets.
I know. I love that this is what it turned into after, like I said, all the hours of trying to figure out what they could be doing.
No, but it's great because it totally works. Really what it's about is the whole community coming together and that this is what you had to do. If you had to get out there and help, you know.
Yeah, and it really brings the whole ridge together and it really helps them, you know, because it works, it helps them see Roger as a captain and really respect him for the first time. I mean, it's a huge win for him.
Yeah. Look at that boat with the teal sails. That's just gorgeous.
You know.
Now, this I remember having a lot of talk in the writer's room about whether Jamie should challenge him to the card game or whether it should be a duel or whether it should be a fight. Didn't we really go back and forth about that? Because a card game is not the most exciting thing to watch on television.
Yeah. And in the source material, it wasn't even, we don't see it. I mean, he does have this card game, but it's not even from Jamie's point of view. He tells Claire about it later. So I think there was a lot of debate about like, do we even see it or... You know, at one point I think it was billiards. Like, we were trying to figure out.
That's right.
Because it's a difficult thing, you know.
You know, I don't think we've ever had billiards in any episode. And we've always talked about it because it did exist back then. Yeah. And we've tried to put it in.
Yeah. I think in one draft I had Tryon coming. Like, his gift was, like, a billiards table. And then it ended up, and like that was like his wedding gift, and then that's why it was there, and then they were playing it.
Wow, yeah, that would have been. But what about ping pong?
Ping pong, ooh, that would have been cool. Like bocce.
They could have invented ping pong.
That'd have been so good. Yeah, but at the end of the day, I think we were like, you know, it's not really about what the game is, it's about like the dramatic purpose of what they're doing here. And so I think the fact that Jamie kind of puts Wiley in a corner here is really the idea.
Exactly. And that's what we end up having to do a lot of in the writer's room is like distill it down to what this is the scene really about. And it's never about the toys or the props or the, you know, it's always just how can we get the emotion of the scene across. And once you distill it down to that, you know.
Yeah. I also remember being like, why would Tryon give Duncan Ennis a billiards table if he has one arm? I think that was like. An issue I ran into, but it's more about
although
the
I think we're playing Duncan that he has both arms, I believe, in the TV version. I'm trying to remember if we explored
I have to go back and look. I thought we were saying he had one. Maybe that's an earlier version.
Now, this is a very iconic scene in the book, and there's a lot of spirited discussion around this scene because there are some people that just feel that this isn't something that Jamie would have done, maybe, to take her rings. It seems un-Jamie-like on the surface of it. But he is a very proud man, and he sometimes does make decisions based on pride. But the key is that he's confident enough to know that he's going to win.
Right.
It rings back. And that even if he didn't win, he'd probably find a way to, you know, find this guy later. And even if he had to, you know, rob their wagon on the way out of town or whatever, he would not have let the rings go.
Right.
But it's a, you know, this isn't, we have to have conflict in their relationship and couples fight, and we want it to be when they do fight, I mean, one thing I like about this show is they don't bicker. They don't fight about nothing. If they're going to fight, it's got to be a weighty subject where you see both people's sides.
Yeah.
And I love this scene because it is like Jamie in the passion of the moment. He's like, I have to win. I have to get this information from this man so that we can take revenge on Bonnet, who, you know, assaulted our daughter.
Yeah.
But Claire, I like her comeback that you have there, is of like, I think later she says, I thought Stephen Bonnet was done taking stuff from us, and we should, you know, we let him again take something from us in our quest for revenge. Mm-hmm. It's not worth taking the symbol of their love and Frank's love that, mm-hmm. you know, so I think it's a really, impactful scene, powerful, and it's one that I know the audience has been waiting to see for a long time. I think they'd have been disappointed if we didn't have this scene, although we did it slightly differently. Mm-hmm. And
but it is a really powerful scene, you know, and I think Jamie is he is blinded by his hatred of Bonnet a little bit, but they definitely both have points. They both have a valid side, and it helps them come together. And in the end, it forced them to address something they hadn't addressed before.
Yeah.
About how they feel about Bonnet and what they're doing going forward, and if they're on the same page about this and what they're going to do. Oh, the locust. There's a real one.
I just said no locusts were harmed in the making, and there she goes.
Well,
no.
We didn't see it.
That was fake. That was fake, you guys. She probably, knowing Sophie, she probably took that locust home and made it into a pet. She's such a nice person.
Oh, yeah.
Aww. Oh, okay.
Oh,
this scene, I gotta say, I was knocked out by it, and I truly think that this scene is one of the best scenes this whole season.
Oh, thank you. I loved writing this scene, and I was so happy because Steve and Allison were on set when they were shooting it, and Steve texted me. I was on the For All Mankind set, and I got a text from Steve that was like, everyone has a box of tissues on set because Maria just, they both do such a great job.
Oh, they both,
and like
Duncan LaCroix.
Yeah.
Our Duncan, the other Duncan, is a phenomenal actor, and I think
it's like a writer's dream to write for both of them together.
It's a writer's dream.
I was like, I felt so lucky to be able to do this.
And this is a nice long scene. Yeah. I remember watching this at playback, and we get to see it on a big screen during playback, where we're doing the sound mixing and the music and all that. And I think the whole room was just mesmerized by this scene. Mm-hmm. And there was not a dry eye. Even all the sound mixers, all the guys that are pretty tough customers. I always know an episode is great when I can see these guys kind of with their sleeves up, wiping their face. And this scene just killed everybody. It did. And
it was a lot of...
I think you don't expect this. I hope the fans are surprised. I mean, that's one of the things about writing from books is, we have a wonderful wealth of material, but at the same time, if it means that everybody that watching loves the books and they're going to know every single thing that happens, I think that occasionally you do have to surprise them, and there has to be mm-hmm. something that they didn't expect that just turns their heads. And I think, you know, maybe TV audiences may think, oh, you know, here's the part where the guy shows up and it stops the wedding, you know, mm-hmm. because he loves her and she's going to talk her into it and she's going to be swept off her feet. And this goes a very different direction, and it's just heartbreaking.
Right. And especially because we've seen where she's coming from emotionally with her daughters and with everything that happened in her past. And
if we hadn't seen that, and if we hadn't actually played those scenes, we might have, she might have come off as unlikable, right. unsympathetic here, where we'd be like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
He came for you. He's a good guy. He said, please wait for him. Why couldn't you have waited?
Mm-hmm.
And now that you've seen that, you know why she couldn't wait.
Yeah. Yeah, it totally, like, I think it was so necessary. It makes it even more painful, you know, that she just can't allow herself to be with him.
No, it's a show not tell. That's why they say show not tell, because if she'd have just told the story, I lost my daughters, and we hadn't seen it.
Right.
But seeing it, it's kind of seared into your gut when you see that opening.
Yeah.
And you just feel the love these two have, and they're the doomed lovers, you know, and there's not a happy ending in this episode.
Right.
She chooses someone else, mm-hmm. and
yeah. And it's realistic, you know, it's like she's, like I said, she's a pragmatic woman and she has good reason to be. And she's at a point in her life where she, I think she just knows that not that her days of happiness are over, but just that, like, you know, this is what she has to do to survive.
And the reason that they both love each other so much is they're both stubborn and mm-hmm. they admire that in each other. And you know, what happens when the thing that attracts you to the person is actually the thing that keeps you apart from them?
Right.
Because she knows, she admires the kind of man he is, but she doesn't want that for her life.
Yeah.
But she still thinks highly of him because she knows he cares and he's dedicated to this cause. He loves her because of how stubborn she is. He knows he's not going to be able to talk her into something.
Right.
And if he could, he wouldn't love her,
right.
because it would mean that she didn't have that iron will of her own where she's not going to be talked out of this. So
Right. It's
two people who are really kind of cut from the same cloth and
respect each other and respect what each other is passionate about.
And I love this, the brooch that he gives her.
Yeah.
It's called a Luckin Booth, and it is, we researched this and I believe it was suggested by, Trisha, our costume designer, I believe is the one that we had it designed. It's a very romantic Scottish symbol of love from the 17th century. And it can be a token of friendship or even betrothal.
Hmm.
And it's usually the shape of a heart. In our case, it's the two entwined hearts. And sometimes they're like a crown with a heart, but I remember we looked at a lot of designs, Meryl and I remember, and looked at many designs to pick out this particular one, and we wanted it to be something. I think we looked at other things that could be given to her, like what the necklace should be when we were in production, but what was cool about the hearts is, you know, it was something that she could feel. Since she's blind, she could feel the shape of it and know and recognize what it was. Because if it was just a necklace with a round stone,
right. It
wouldn't have been special. But when she feels it, she sees that it's their two hearts intertwined. And you were bringing something up today earlier about how we didn't have it when we were shooting this scene. It wasn't, we were still designing.
Yeah, when I wrote it, it was just it was a necklace, and I think that's what you're saying. It's like, so when it went, when you guys
in the first
were
draft
there,
of the
it was,
script,
yeah,
it
the
was
first
a,
draft.
A necklace, and then we often during the rewrites things can change, and I believe that when they shot this scene, they had a generic one, and they had it in her hand, so we see the edge of it in her hand. You'll notice, but you don't see it, the whole thing. And we actually got it designed and made special for this. And then we shot an insert later and inserted it. And sometimes production is required to do that, just because sometimes not everything is shot at the same time, obviously.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it turned out beautiful, because I didn't see it for the first time until I watched this cut. And I was like, wow, it's great. It's so much better than a necklace.
Yeah, it was a little more unique, and, that's the contributions of all the different departments, obviously. It's not something we might have known about or even knew to do research, because I think we talked about, you know, could it be a bird shape, or could it be a one heart by itself, or I know we went through a lot of different things, but this is one of those instances where it's the perfect thing. Yeah. Because another thing is that it matches the Luckin' Booth that Murtaugh wears on his own coat.
Mm.
He wears one that's similar. So when she feels it, she realizes that he had it made to match his.
Oh, yeah.
So it's great. Almost like it's their wedding,
yeah.
You know, like their version of wedding rings for each other.
Yeah, that's so great. I was going to say also the whole, when she says at the beginning of the scene that her family motto is "I shine, not burn," that was something that I realized in writing this, and I wanted to tie into the episode because it's so symbolic for me of who Jocasta is and how I imagine she was raised, kind of to be strong and to, you know, to not let the fires of what happens to you in life really let, you know, destroy you. And that's how she is. And I thought that would be something that would be what she would be thinking of on this day. You know, those words that her father taught her.
Yeah.
So I liked bringing that into this.
No,
scene
that's
as well.
That's excellent. That was a great idea because that is who she is. She's very, her passions are closely held.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, she will not be burned up.
Right.
By her passion.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's really what she's saying.
She's controlled.
Yeah. Yeah, and like she has this fiery passion for Murtaugh, but she's not letting it consume her. And that goes into the title as well.
Ugh, this just kills me.
Yeah. Oh, God. This is so sad.
And I also kind of love that Ulysses, who, you know, he was never a Murtaugh fan.
Yeah.
He's not the Murtaugh, the president of the Murtaugh fan
club.
At all. But there, I think he's been around now long enough around them to recognize how much Jocasta cares about him and mm-hmm. how happy that he makes her.
Right. Yeah, and, I thought it was such a big, cool thing that he lets him in.
Yeah, know? When he's like, hey, I found this guy outside. And, you know, I mean, he didn't have to let him in. His job would usually be to, like, stay away. She's getting married, dude.
Yeah.
Don't mess it up.
But he also knows Tryon is downstairs. And he knows he could be killed.
Oh, Murtaugh took a huge chance coming here.
Yeah.
In fact, didn't we at one point? Well, it's kind of the reverse of the wedding in 501. Murtaugh's at the wedding at the ridge, and she sneaks out to the lean-to where Murtaugh's hiding.
Yeah.
And now Murtaugh sneaks into
That's
her
true.
Room.
I actually hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
That is a nice little echo.
Now, this was a difficult scene because there were a lot of opinions about what this should be. Jamie's a little tipsy here. He's been drinking. He's very... You know, he did what he said. He brought the rings back.
Yeah.
But Claire's like, that is not the point.
Right.
There's a bit of a...
I think he was
there's...
expecting her to just be like, oh, great. Well, we're good now. But she's definitely not having it.
Yeah. Well, this is one of their fights, and it's about something that matters, you know?
Right.
And so I think there was a lot of talk about how this fight should go. Obviously, it turns passionate at a certain point.
Yeah. This is a scene from the source material as well, and we wanted to preserve it because I know it's a big part of the book, and it's, you know, they haven't really had an intimate moment for a while, so it was good to see them have it.
Well, these are two equals, you know, and so it's, you never feel that, you know, that there's an imbalance in the power, you know, and so I think that's why it can be sexy and it can be passionate, even if it's laced with a bit of like, I'm not happy with what you did, but I think she understands that this is part of Jamie's heroism is that he did this for his daughter. He's not gonna let anyone mess with their family,
right?
And
he is stubborn. She knows that about him. She's always known it about him.
So the fans are always like, the scene in the stables.
I know. We were aware that was a big fan favorite, so we wanted to be sure to keep it in there.
Yeah. But then
it leads to a conversation that I think they really needed to have.
Yeah, and I think by the time he says, look, I'm putting these rings back on you and I swear they'll never come off again. I think, you know, this reminds me a little of Matt's episode, The Reckoning, which I really loved in season one, I believe it was. Because after, you know, he ends up, you know, having to, you know, discipline her for putting all their lives at stake. And people were like, oh, my God, he hit her, you know, even though that was how, you know, how it was done at the time. It was period appropriate, but it was still shocking.
Yeah.
But what made us able to pull off a scene with, like that is that at the end she holds a knife to his throat and says, never again, or I'll cut your heart out.
Yeah. I love
and
that.
So she's a strong woman who's like, OK, this happened, but, you know, it can never happen again. And he agrees. Mm-hmm. And so. And I feel like there's a little bit of the same thing going on here where he's like, look, I know what I did, but I'll put these rings on you. And I swear, I give you my word, they'll never come off your hand again. And I think that's why, no matter what, you know, how big of a fight they've had, she stands up to him and he comes around and he's always the progressive man that learns from her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that reminded me of that scene too, the way that we did this, because it was... It was almost like he needed to be reminded in a way that, like, you know,
yeah,
that she is a modern woman and sometimes, you know, she's going to act that way and that, you know, that's what he loves about her. I like that line a lot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Stephen Bonnet, that line where she says he, you know, reached in my throat to get this ring away from me.
Yeah.
And that's part of why she was like, I don't want, you know, you to let him basically take our rings away and the symbol of our marriage away.
Yeah. He's already done so much to them.
You know, killed Leslie in front of her. It just really opened up an old wound for Claire and touched something very raw that sparked this in her. So they're both right here and they make up, you know, and that's what couples do, you know, go through something and come out the other side. And I think that's why people love them and love Outlander. Right. Now here is Mr. Forbes.
Yeah. I remember doing research into coffee houses of the time. I learned a lot of interesting coffee facts.
That's right. Coffee was just becoming a thing, right?
Yeah.
Because tea was a big thing. People were like, what's this?
Yeah, and I think because of all the controversy with the tea party and everything, that coffee was becoming more in fashion. I love how Bonnet dresses in this.
Oh, I know. He's great.
He's so great.
Now, this isn't in the book, right?
It is not, I don't believe.
Bonnet learns that, I believe... He may learn. He needs to learn that Jemmy has come into
into
money,
into the inheritance. I love Forbes here. He's so nervous.
And also at play is the fact that Forbes has a bone to pick because he tried to court Brianna.
Right.
Back when Jocasta was looking for a husband for her when they thought Roger was not coming back.
Right, and he feels snubbed from that.
Yes, he feels snubbed from that, so he's an opportunist, and this is a way to sort of kill two birds with one stone, get some money, and maybe get back at Brianna for his pride being wounded. Yeah. There's a lot of wounded pride in this episode.
Yeah, it's kind of like the running theme.
Including this guy.
Yeah.
Because, like, he went and passed all this legislation.
Yeah.
But now none of the regulators are taking him up on his...
Yeah. Like, it was not what he was expecting. I think he's just... He's angry that he doesn't have the authority that he thought he had over these people.
And here's where Jamie is facing the thing that he's been trying to avoid all this time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, he didn't want war.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want.
Yeah, he's tried his best to protect his family and to keep everyone, you know, everything calm and then it's about to come to his worst fear.
Absolutely. And that's a great note to end on, and a great cliffhanger, and a very, very good episode.
Yeah, it was great. I was great watching it with you. I'm so happy we got to
I know, this see is it fun.
Together. Yeah, I know. It's been a while since I saw it, so I'm very happy with how it turned out. I'm so excited for everyone to see it.
All right. Well, fantastic. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you guys. Oh, God. What? We forgot one thing.
I know. I was thinking about that this whole time.
Well, tell them your whiskey, and we'll sign off with that.
Okay. Well, we are drinking Cleveland Underground finished with honey locust wood, which is obviously a nod to
the locust. Our locust. So here's to the locust.
Yay.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. Cheers to you.
Yay.